We're talking about research to help minimize middle school angst. It is the morning show. I'm Kate Archer. Ken, thanks for being here. Researchers at Lawrence University in Appleton have this new grant that will allow them to develop an app centered around mindfulness exercises. And it's geared toward adolescents who struggle with rumination. That is like dwelling on negative things sometimes until it consumes them and they just can't move on. Rumination is more prevalent in women than in men, and often takes hold at the onset of puberty. Do you have a child who struggles with rumination? Have you tried to help address it? We're at 800-642-1234. Lori Hilt is an associate professor of psychology at Lawrence University. Lori, welcome to the Ideas Network.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
You've been leading this study, this adolescent rumination study and effort for the past couple years. We also call this teenage angst. But before we get into what words and terminology are more correct than the other, can you tell us what this study is and what is rumination?
Sure. Rumination is basically what you were saying, dwelling on negative emotions and thoughts, and it's getting caught up in them, getting stuck, and it keeps people from engaging in things that would actually help their mood, like problem solving or just being able to let go of those negative emotions and move on. So it seems to prevent other coping strategies from working.
So how is this different then from like teenage moodiness?
Right. Well, certainly teenage moodiness is, this is part of it. So teens undergo a lot of stressors. You mentioned puberty, certainly all the changes that go with puberty, all the difficulties in adjusting to new schools when kids are going to middle school and then transitioning to high school. And so as kids deal with these stressors, they sometimes worry, which is a form of focusing on the future in a repetitive way, or they sometimes ruminate, which tends to be focusing more on past things in a repetitive way. And when they get stuck in those patterns, that makes it harder for them to deal and makes them more likely to develop things like depression and anxiety. So what we're trying to do in our study is help kids recognize their emotions and come up with a better coping strategy for them so they don't get stuck in these patterns.
So you mentioned depression there. That can be very serious. Do you see that this habit of rumination could emerge in depression?
Yes, it seems that rumination is one of the best predictors of developing future depression. And then once people are depressed, of course, they have more negative information and emotions to ruminate about. So it's kind of a cycle. So we want to try to prevent rumination in order to prevent depression.
We're talking with Lori Hilt, and she's here to discuss an app that's aimed at teaching children mindfulness. She's a psychology professor at Lawrence University. Are you someone who's benefited from practicing mindfulness? What about it helps you cope with the stresses of your life? Do you have a child who is dealing with rumination? Join in at 800-642-1234. You can email ideas at WPR.org. Lori, the grant you received from the National Institutes of Health is for more than $360,000 over several years. Can you tell us more about what you aim to do with this funding?
Sure. So over the course of the grant, we're going to be bringing in 150 local adolescents to our lab, and we'll be giving them one of two versions of our app and asking them to use it for a period of time to see how it might impact the way that they process emotions. So the money is going to allow us to study this in a scientific way. We've piloted the app over the last several years, and it certainly has given us some promising results, but it's really important for us to test it in this larger study, so that's what the money will let us do.
Yeah, so what is happening on this mobile app?
So with the app, it notifies the adolescent three times a day to basically do an emotional check-in. So when they get a notification, the next opportunity they have, they go into the app and it asks them basically to check in on how they're feeling. It asks 10 different questions about their emotions and what they're focusing on at the moment. And then in one version of the app, adolescents are given a short mindfulness exercise. So these exercises last anywhere from 1 to 10 minutes. And what they do is they help the adolescent focus on the present moment. They help them notice the bodily sensations that they're experiencing or focus on their breath. And so basically, we're hoping that through engaging in these emotion check-ins and focusing on the present moment, that will give them another way to cope with their emotions rather than getting caught up in them and dwelling on them.
So is mindfulness then just focusing on the present moment, or is there more to it than that?
Yeah, I mean, that's really the heart of it, is focusing on the present moment, but it's doing so in a particular way, in a non-judgmental way, a very neutral way. And so it's doing it without judgment, essentially. So intentionally focusing on how one is feeling right now. So much of our time, we're focused on the past, you know, oh, I said that, why did I say it that way? Or something in the future, oh, I have to do this, I hope I'm going to do okay at it. And so mindfulness helps us be in the present moment. And research has shown that we're happier when we're in the present moment.
Lori, why do you want to tackle adolescent rumination through an app? Because there could be other ways you could approach this, I would assume, as a psychologist.
Sure. Well, the reason that we wanted to develop an app is because teens are spending so much time using mobile devices, and you've probably heard about some of the negative effects of using mobile devices. And so we thought, well, if teens are using these anyway, why don't we harness them for good and teach them some coping strategies using their mobile devices?
And when they use the app, is it because they are told to use the app at a certain time, or do they turn to it when they feel they're going into this cycle of dwelling on something? What triggers the use of the app?
Well, it could be both. So the app randomly notifies them 3 times a day to use it, but we do tell them that they're welcome to go in any time and use it. And what we hope is that through using it regularly, they will start to naturally turn to these strategies on their own. And so that's one of the things that we're testing. So we'll be following the adolescents for 6 months after they're done using the app to see if there are any lasting effects of it.
Well, let's take a call now. Matt joining us from Racine. Hi, Matt.
Hi, how are you doing?
Good.
Okay, my question is this, because you're talking and I do all these things. I have a head injury, and I'm wondering if that has to do with it, rumination because of head injury, or if it's just the way I am. I can take my answer off the air.
Thanks, Matt. Yeah, Lori, what do you think there?
Well, certainly, you know, in terms of what causes rumination, we're still trying to figure that out. There are a lot of factors that may come into play. But we do know that part of rumination is the brain being structured in a certain way. Over time, we develop habits. So I would imagine that perhaps injuring a part of the brain could make it harder to focus on positive things and maybe make it easier to get stuck in some of these cycles. So I think the jury is still out on that.
I'm wondering, is, you know, rumination something that can be, you know, part of our DNA, our genetic makeup, or is it more about, you know, the chemistry in our body and certain, you know, whether we have a certain makeup of things going on at, you know, a certain time, like testosterone?
Mm-hmm. Well, again, I think most things in psychology are kind of a combination of biological, psychological, and social factors. And with rumination, there's probably a lot of different things that contribute to it. So first of all, you have to have some negative emotional experiences because that's what fuels rumination. And most of us encounter negative experiences in our life, but not everyone gets stuck in rumination. So what are those things? Certainly one's temperament, which we think has sort of a genetic basis, may affect how well we can control our mind and pay attention to different things. So that might have a part of it.
And
also socialization.
Let's pause right there on temperament and socialization with Lori Hilt. She's a psychology professor at Lawrence University studying rumination. Your questions as well, 800-642-1234. Do you struggle with rumination? Let's talk about it. Back in a minute here on the Ideas Network. We're talking about adolescent mental health, the issue of rumination, dwelling on negative feelings. It is the morning show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Adolescent rumination can lead to depression in adulthood, as we've learned, and researchers hope that mindfulness exercises delivered through an app might bring some beneficial results in curbing this tendency at a younger age. Do you see rumination tendencies in your tween? What do you do? Maybe you're an adult and you think you had some form of this? Do you wish you could get some kind of help? What is life like for you now? Join in with your questions, your insights, 800-642-1234. Lori Hilt is an associate professor of psychology at Lawrence University, and she stays with us. Lori, when we left off there, you were explaining how there are both physical and psychological bases for adolescent rumination. What do we know about socialization and temperament and things like that?
Yeah. So one of the things that we've looked at is the way that parents and other individuals socialize adolescents to cope with their emotions, starting from a very young age. And one thing we know is that rumination is more common in girls. And that might be partially because we do tend to socialize girls to internalize their feelings more, and we might not encourage them to engage in active problem solving as much. We also know that over-controlling parenting can be a risk factor for developing rumination. And so those are some of the areas that we might think about if we're trying to prevent rumination in our own children.
When you say over-controlling parenting, what might that look like, and how do you see the link there to rumination?
Sure. So over-controlling parenting really has to do with managing one's children. Now, obviously, when children are younger, we have to have more control over them. But when they get into adolescence, it's important to give them autonomy. It's important to let them make choices, to fail, because they're learning how to cope with life. And they get these opportunities at a young age when the stakes are lower, so that when they are off on their own, it's they've had some practice with dealing with those things. So over-controlling parenting is kind of not giving kids those opportunities to learn on their own. And so what we think might happen is then kids are starting to internalize those messages of maybe I'm not good enough, I can't handle things on my own, and that might lead to kind of a ruminative style.
Let's bring in Ella now, joining us from Milwaukee. Hi, Ella.
Hey, how are you?
Good. What's
good
on your mind?
Yeah, I'm just calling in. I am someone who has OCD, so I grew up having a lot of ruminations, especially in those teenage years, and was often recommended to use apps of varieties. And I'm just curious to know what this app will have in difference to apps that are already out there.
Ella, when you say you tried a variety of apps, what did you try?
So the Calm app, it's a free mobile app that I had seen through various therapists who recommended it. Granted, you do have to pay for it at a certain point, but that was an app that was kind of used for like meditation and mindfulness exercises.
How, may I ask, Ella, how did it work for you? Did you see an impact?
Yeah, I would definitely say I saw an impact. Really, too, in addition to that, being taught mindfulness exercises through therapy was also very beneficial. I could definitely see an app with therapy. I'm a big advocate for therapy, though, so I'm always going to throw in therapy being such a great point with rumination. And I just love that it's being spoken about, because as a teenager, you know, I'm in my late 20s now, that was not something that was ever spoken about. So I just really appreciate hearing that. Hopefully other teenagers like me who are so confused can get some light on the what's going on.
Well, let's bring Lori into the conversation here. How will your app be different than other products that are out there to find mindfulness?
Yeah, this is a great question. There are so many apps out there that, you know, are for teaching mindfulness. And one of the main goals for our research is really to just study it in a scientific way. So a lot of the apps that are out there haven't been studied. And so we don't know how effective they are. And so our app is not necessarily all that different from other apps, but one thing that is different is that it notifies people throughout the day to check in, and then based on how they're feeling, it recommends particular exercises, whereas some other apps, you just kind of go in and choose your own exercises. But mainly what we're trying to do is see how well this works, what dose do you need, can you even learn mindfulness in these short little bursts? Because as Ella mentioned, I thought she had a great point, learning mindfulness in therapy is also excellent, and that you're going to get much more intensive practice. But for some people, it's not realistic to have the time to do that, or maybe they're not feeling like they need therapy. And so we're trying to see if there's something that they can do to kind of get them through and maybe prevent further problems from happening by doing something in the shorter term.
Ella also mentioned that adolescent rumination is now just coming more into the light, that it wasn't talked about in the past. Do you find that in researching from a psychological standpoint, from a psychology professor, are we just learning about what rumination can really do and its impact?
Yes, I think we are. The term rumination has been around for quite a long time, and the research on its involvement in depression has also been around for about 20 or 30 years. But we kind of have always studied this more in adults, and we haven't really realized, I think, the impact that rumination can have on our overall mental health. And so as we're realizing that, we're starting to study it in younger kids when it's first developing and when depression and anxiety are first developing. So it offers a real opportunity to try to do some preventive interventions.
And Ella also mentioned obsessive compulsive disorder. Do we find any links there?
Yes. Obsessive compulsive disorder by definition involves intrusive, unwanted, repetitive thoughts. And rumination, shares some things in common with that, in that there's these repetitive thoughts, although they do tend to be experienced a little bit differently in people who don't have OCD.
So Mike from Madison called in but couldn't stay with us. Mike went through rumination as an adolescent, wasn't taught coping skills, and Mike thinks it led to depression and anger and said things got harder. And as Mike has gotten older and things change, it gets harder when you don't have the coping skills to manage. And Mike had to relearn these skills as an adult. Is that something that you see in your research, that if you don't address it early on, that this will stay with you in adulthood?
Yeah, we find that in psychology, whatever you do, whatever habits you form, they strengthen over time. So if you start ruminating as a child and you don't learn other ways to cope, that's going to continue throughout adulthood. But the great thing about humans is that we can change, and habits of mind can change with practice. And that's really what the study that we're doing is all about. We're trying to see how much we have to do in order to change. So research on mindfulness has shown that intensive practice, so spending at least a couple of hours a day, or somewhere between maybe 1 and 2 hours a day for 8 weeks, can really change the way the brain is structured and how we cope with emotions. And so what we're trying to do is see, can you change those habits of mind if you do even smaller doses of this?
Let's bring in Kelly now in Cascade. Hi, Kelly.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call. This is a great subject. I definitely ruminated quite a bit in my late grade school, into high school years, and into college. And I still do from time to time. I've developed a lot of mindfulness practices. But what I really noticed about myself was I was looping round and round with questions and kind of deeper inquiries about life and purpose and what am I here for. And when I didn't have an outlet for those, they just kind of kept looping. And as soon as I found safe spaces to bring those out in the open with other people that could really receive the depth of those questions and give me the space to wrestle with them out loud, or through journal writing, that kind of thing, it really helps. And I think adolescents are dealing with so much. I mean, there's just so much depth of all kinds of things going on. And I feel like we skim the surface a lot of times, or feel like they're not capable of handling those deeper questions. But I think they really are wrestling with deep questions and need people that will give them the space to find real answers.
Lori, what do you think of that?
I think the caller brings up a great point, that a lot of people, when they're ruminating, they do it because they are trying to understand themselves and they're asking these questions. But as she pointed out, it's a loop that one gets stuck in. So I thought she brought up some great points about more adaptive ways to self-reflect and get those questions answered. And so talking with other people, journaling, I think those are all great alternatives to getting stuck in these loops. So I think it's great to point out some of those alternative strategies for adolescents.
Lori, thank you for joining us.
You're welcome. Thanks so much for having me. It was great to chat with you.
Lori Hilt is an associate professor of psychology at Lawrence University in Appleton, and she's developing an online app carrying out the research that will teach children mindfulness. Coming up, we talk with a UW-Madison researcher about what so-called ghost particles can tell us about the universe. We head to Antarctica to check in on the Ice Cube Observatory. That's right after this news update. Stay with us here on the Ideas Network. We're talking neutrinos in a unique detector buried deep within the ice at the South Pole. It is the morning show. I'm Kate Archer Kent, and we're checking in on what subatomic particles tell us about our universe. It's called the Ice Cube Neutrino Observatory. It's designed to spy on some of the strangest and coolest particles in the cosmos. So let's go right to the science with your questions wide open here. What questions do you have about neutrinos and other subatomic particles in our universe? What do you think are some of the most exciting discoveries in astrophysics? Bring it on, 800-642-1234. Cale Hansen is a professor of physics at the UW-Madison. He's also director of the Wisconsin Ice Cube Particle Astrophysics Center and director of operations for the Ice Cube Neutrino Observatory. Cale, welcome to the Ideas Network.
Good morning, Kate.
So this observatory has the largest neutrino detector in the world. We need to start with, what are neutrinos? Can you give us the short story?
Yeah, real short story. So neutrinos are one of the particles that actually make up matter in the universe. There are 12 of these particles, and neutrinos are the lightest of these particles. They have some interesting properties, such as they're chargeless, and they are very, very weakly interacting with everything else. So that kind of makes them special.
Why does that make them special, that they don't, you know, cling on to other things and they don't really have much of a charge?
Well, it makes them actually incredibly useful for doing astronomy. I mean, astronomy's been done for, you know, centuries with just using light particles. And we're actually trying to open up a new field of astronomy that uses particles. We actually have opened up a new field of astronomy that uses particles other than, other than light particles, other than astronomers kind of looking through your standard optical telescopes. And that's what the Ice Cube Neutrino Observatory is. It's a neutrino telescope.
Yeah, so neutrino detection is sometimes described as being like a telescope. How do you explain that? What are you trying to find there?
So what we're trying to find is where the neutrinos are coming from. We're actually trying to find where cosmic rays are coming from, but neutrinos are an important piece to this puzzle. When we look up at the sky with Ice Cube, or look down at the sky, actually Ice Cube is kind of interesting in that it's a telescope inside the ice. And it looks all around. It looks up at the sky above, and it looks at the sky below, going all the way through the Earth. And the reason that we call it a neutrino telescope is that we can actually look at these neutrino events. We get hundreds of thousands of these neutrino events. Most of them are from the atmosphere. But on the order of a couple dozen per month, they're actually from the cosmos. They're from the astrophysical sources. And we're trying to figure out, by pointing back to those sources, just like a conventional telescope does, we're trying to locate where these sources are in the sky and match them up with objects that we, you know, either we know about already, or maybe objects that we don't know about.
Can you give us a visual of what the Ice Cube Observatory looks like, at the South Pole? How big is it? Where is it?
So Ice Cube's name actually comes from the fact that it's a cubic kilometer of ice. So it's literally one kilometer by 1 kilometer by 1 kilometer of ice that's been instrumented with about 5,000 optical sensors. And what we do is we drill holes and put these optical sensors deep in the ice in these holes, about a mile deep. And we actually use the ice as what's called a Cherenkov radiator. When the neutrinos interact in the ice, they give off light particles, visual light particles, and this array of 5,000 sensors detects those light particles. And by looking at the patterns and the time, we can tell where the neutrino is, what kind of neutrino it was, how energetic it was, and where it came from on the sky.
Wow. And so neutrinos give scientists a lot of information then about other objects and how things move in our whole universe. They kind of give us clues.
So yeah, neutrinos, as I, you know, so as I was saying before, they're extremely weakly interacting. So they're very penetrating particles. A neutrino, one of the stats I'd like to quote is a neutrino can pass through a light year of lead without interacting. And so this makes them useful for doing astronomy because we can actually use these neutrinos, unlike any other particles that we know out there, to image the sky at high energies. Everything else that we know of, light particles, other particles, you know, cosmic ray particles, they're just not, they can't go back and point back to sources at high energies on the sky. So neutrinos kind of open up this new window that we've never been able to see before.
We're talking with Cale Hansen. He's Director of Operations for the IceCube Neutrino Observatory, which we're learning about. You can join in at 800-642-1234. What are your questions about neutrinos and other subatomic particles? What are your questions about particle physics? Do you remember when you first heard of neutrinos? What do you think? What do you want to know about astrophysics? Join in at 800-642-1234. You can email ideas at WPR.org. So, Cale, the Ice Cube Observatory in Antarctica, why is it there? Why do you do that research there?
Great question. It's the ice. I mean, it's all about the ice. So we need a place on the Earth. There are a couple of places on the Earth that you could construct such a neutrino observatory. One, there's actually a neutrino observatory, smaller, but has been operating for quite a long time, that's deep within a lake in Russia, Lake Baikal. Collaborators or, you know, the scientific community is also building a neutrino observatory, much like IceCube, in the Mediterranean Sea. But we decided to go down to the South Pole and use the ice because ice is actually turns out to be extremely transparent when you get down about a mile deep. And it also has the property that it's extremely stable. It's obviously quite an endeavor to drill these holes a mile deep. But once we actually make the holes and put the sensors in and they refreeze, it's an incredibly stable environment. So it's a very low-noise environment, and almost it's perfect for doing neutrino astronomy.
And even with climate change and the warming climate, ice melt, that still keeps it, you still have a stable environment there to do this research.
Well, I mean, Greenland is certainly experiencing unheard of ice melt right now. It's, I guess, fortunately for us at the South Pole, it's still pretty darn cold down there. So when we get down there, the South Pole station is open from about early November to middle of February, and it never gets above, I think the warmest recorded temperature there is about 7 degrees Fahrenheit. So it's still quite cold there, and there's still, you know, there's still no ice melt at the South Pole itself. Now, of course, IceCube is, it's really literally in the center of the Antarctic continent on top of a sheet of about 3,000 meters of ice. So there's quite a bit of ice there, and it's quite cold, yeah.
So when you go there, where do you stay?
There's a station. So the United States Antarctic Program is run by the National Science Foundation. That's our sponsor. That's who actually provided most of the funding to build IceCube. And they've been operating stations there since, I think, the late 50s. And in about 20 years ago, they constructed the most modern station. So when you go down, and, you know, most of us, you know, scientists will go down for a couple of weeks per year. And we stay in, it's basically a large above the ice dormer with, you know, staterooms and galleys. And there's even a gymnasium down there.
So last month, the IceCube Observatory got this $23 million grant from the National Science Foundation. How will that grant money be used on IceCube?
We're putting in what's called the IceCube upgrade, and it's the first in what we hope to be a series of extensions to the IceCube facility. This upgrade is actually not going to focus primarily on neutrino astrophysics, but actually using neutrinos from the atmosphere to study, it's kind of like a beam, that we can exploit to study the properties of the neutrinos themselves.
Let's take a call now. Let's go to Ray joining us from Whitefish Bay. Hi, Ray.
Good morning.
Good morning.
I have a question. Since neutrinos so rarely interact with any matter, and so when you have an event occur, when it interacts, how do you know what person it comes from? I mean, you only have one point. How do you tell where in the universe that originated?
That's a great question, Ray. So what happens is when the neutrinos interact in the ice, they turn into their charged particle doublets. So a neutrino, a muon neutrino, for example, will turn into a muon. And what happens is that muon then flies through the ice and actually deposits a long track. And sometimes these tracks can be kilometers long. The muons are also fairly penetrating particles. And the muon, as it's exiting or as it's transiting the ice, it's radiating all of this Cherenkov radiation. And that radiation comes off and is detected by the array of sensors that we put down there. And by reconstructing, by looking at the pattern of the light, I mean, you can almost look at it just by eye or, you know, with the aid of a computer that reconstructs the event patterns that happen in the array, you can almost kind of see it looks like a line. And so by using sophisticated algorithms on, you know, computers that are constantly running at the South Pole, we can actually reconstruct what the directions of these muon tracks are to less than a degree and point back to less than a degree on the sky.
So kind of like a trail of breadcrumbs in a way.
Yeah, it's a breadcrumb trail. Right, exactly.
Ray, thanks for the call. So UW-Madison is the lead here on the IceCube Observatory. Who are your other research partners?
So we have a number of other research partners in the United States and also in Europe and in Japan and Korea, too. So it's a worldwide collaboration of over 300 physicists that participate. But UW-Madison, it is the headquarters. the institute here, the Wisconsin IceCube Particle Astrophysics Center, is responsible for doing the daily maintenance and operations of the detector. So we make sure that data is constantly running, that the detector is live and taking data 99.99% of the time so that we don't miss any interesting transient events such as like a stellar collapse in our galaxy that we never know when it's going to happen. So we have to be ready to go at all times.
We're talking about neutrinos, these invisible, nearly massless subatomic particles, which rarely ever interact with normal matter due to their lack of electrical charge. Curious Things and the UW-Madison Research Outpost there. We're learning about it with an update from Cale Hansen. He's Director of Operations for the IceCube Neutrino Observatory. And you can join in with your physics and astrophysics curiosities, 800-642-1234. Do you think it's important for us to research things that have the potential to teach us about the universe, like neutrinos? Call in. You can also email ideas@wpr.org. Back in just a minute here on the Ideas Network. And we're learning about a UW-Madison research outpost at the South Pole that will expand with the help of a $23 million grant. We're learning about the IceCube Neutrino Observatory here on The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. And this research station is getting an upgrade to enhance its capabilities with the intention of providing new insights into the nature of our universe. Your questions about neutrinos and why they matter in astrophysics, join in 800-642-1234. What are your questions about neutrinos and other subatomic particles? Do you remember when you first heard of neutrinos? What did you think? Call in, email ideas@wpr.org. And Cale Hansen stays with us. He's a physics professor at UW-Madison, director of the Wisconsin IceCube Particle Astrophysics Center, director of operations for the IceCube Neutrino Observatory. Let's go to the phones now with Jenny joining us from Madison. Hi, Jenny.
Hi.
What's your question? Yeah.
So my question is, how long does it take to set up the gear in Antarctica?
So you mean set up the gear in Antarctica? Because this is a big operation. Is that what you mean?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Hi, Jenny. So that's a good question. We actually started building IceCube, actually started putting the instrumentation in the ice in 2004. So you only get from early November to mid-February every year to actually deploy the instrumentation. The rest of the year, the station is closed, and there are only a couple of people that stay there. They're called winter over operators that kind of keep the place running. So it took us a while to actually get these 5,000 sensors into the ice. As you can imagine, it's quite an endeavor. So it took us actually 7 years of drilling, and so we started in 2004 and ended in 2010. And by the end of those time, we were putting in about 20 of these strings of instrumentation in every year.
Jenny, what fascinates you about physics or astrophysics?
Well, my dad is involved in physics, so yeah, I'm pretty like, it's cool for me. So yeah.
Well, thanks so much for calling in, Jenny. Kale, you know, we touched on climate change earlier. Matthew from Evansville has a follow-up question, called in to ask how climate change could impact your research over time. Could it skew the results over time?
So for us, actually, climate change is probably not going to affect the taking of the data. Or it won't actually change the way that the Ice Cube Neutrino Observatory operates over its lifetime, which we, you know, anticipate to be on the order of 20, 25 years. However, I can say that climate change has impacted a little bit the operations down there. So as I said, the Ice Cube itself is at the South Pole, right in the center of the continent. But in order to get there, you have to take a plane from this coastal base that's called McMurdo Station, and there actually the airplanes come in from New Zealand and land on ice runways, and in the last couple of years those ice runways have been pretty slushy and have impeded the operations. So it's a little bit harder now than it was 15 years ago when we started building Ice Cube to get equipment and people down to the South Pole.
You're also looking for black holes and exploding stars, is that right?
Yeah, so that's what we're looking for, is anything that's energetic and goes bang in the universe. And so, you know, so black holes are what happens when massive stars eat up all their fuel, use up all of their nuclear fuel, and die. They give off an explosion, and that explosion sends a shock wave of gas ionized gas hurtling throughout the interstellar medium. And we think that those gas shock waves actually act like cosmic brooms and sweep up any of the protons or other material that's just sitting out there in the interstellar medium, and can accelerate it just pretty much like an accelerator lab on the Earth does, and it can accelerate these particles to high energy. So we've been observing these particles called cosmic rays for a hundred years. And we're still not quite sure where they come from. We think they come from these cosmic these supernova explosions, but there are probably also other exotic phenomena, probably related to some supermassive black holes way out there in the distant universe. And that's really what we're going after with Ice Cube.
Let's bring in another call now. Peter in Somerset is with us. Hi, Peter.
Hello. I had a question about you had mentioned that the neutrino was a doublet, and I was wondering if it's truly known that it is a doublet and how that affects neutrino oscillations. And also, as far as the detector, what is the range of energies that the neutrino can have that you can detect, like in electron volts?
Peter, yeah. Thanks. Yeah, Kale.
Great questions, Peter. Okay, so let's take the first one. So a doublet. What is a doublet, and how do we know? So the neutrinos are paired, like I said, with these charged particles. And so there are three flavors of neutrinos, and three flavors of their charged partners. So probably many listeners have heard of an electron. That's the little tiny subatomic particle that orbits nuclei, makes atoms. These electrons are paired with electron neutrinos. There are also, though, heavier versions that you don't see quite so often when you look around you, but they're actually raining we're in a constant rain of these particles that are called muons, and they're heavier versions of electrons, and because they're heavier, they also decay. They only live about 2 microseconds, but they're all around us. You just can't see them. And then finally, there's a very elusive one, very, very heavy and very, very short-lived, called the tau neutrino, and our tau particle, and also has a tau neutrino that's associated with that. The reason that we know that they're doublets is that we've observed them in accelerator laboratories, on the Earth, and we can actually tell when a neutrino interacts that it changes into its doublet particle. That's kind of nice because that helps us, you know, even though we can't see the neutrinos are invisible. We know that if we see its doublet particle, that doublet particle had to come from a neutrino of that flavor. So that helps us kind of tell what the flavor, detect the neutrino, and also tells us what its flavor is. Now, to answer your other question about what's the range of energies of Ice Cube. So Ice Cube, again, in these units called electron volts, and I guess just to give you kind of a scale of what the energy means in kind of in everyday terms. If you talk about a million electron volts or a mega electron volts, that's kind of typical nuclear binding energies. So Ice Cube is sensitive to neutrinos from supernovae in our galaxy in the range of about a million electron volts. But we actually also, and I guess most of the range and most of the events that we detect on a daily basis are energies a million times or even a billion times more energetic. So that's our energy range is about a factor of a billion.
Wow, Cale, that's a lot to digest there. Peter, does that all make sense?
Yes, for the most part. So the doublet is it's a single charge, not like a positive-negative doublet.
It would be a charge and chargeless doublets, right? So there's one charged partner, and then there's one chargeless partner, and those chargeless partners, those neutral partners, are the neutrinos.
Peter, thanks for the call. Cale, as we start to wrap up here, how important is this money from the NSF to keep Ice Cube going?
Well, I mean, it's important in the sense that so we are supported by the NSF to do our operations, and we've been we will continue to be supported, and that will keep the Ice Cube detector itself running, and it will keep the great science that we're doing going for years to come. But we've realized that, you know, as we've operated, I mean, this is the first time we ever really built anyone's really built a detector of this type. We realized things that we thought, we think we can do better if we had another chance. And so this upgrade money, this $23 million, is going to give us another chance to put more instrumentation, more advanced instrumentation, because 20 years has expired, into the ice, and it's going to help us understand better the properties of the ice that Ice Cube uses to detect the neutrinos. And that will actually help Ice Cube itself get a better vision on the universe.
Aha, 2.0. Cale, thanks for joining us.
All right, thanks a lot, Kate.
Cale Hansen is a professor of physics at UW-Madison and director of operations for the Ice Cube Neutrino Observatory. Just ahead, the Green Bay Packers are celebrating 100 seasons of football. And we'll go through the team's long history and why it's considered one of the greatest stories in sports. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. It is The Morning Show. You're listening to the Ideas Network.